In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. This go-round, I'll be chatting with Jeremy Fury of Jeremy and the Harlequins. Based in New York City, their single Wrong Way But the Right Lane is the recent coolest song in the world. Let's give a listen to a portion of it now, and then I'll be speaking with Jeremy on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Manfred here, and joining me for today's coolest conversations is Jeremy Fury of Jeremy and the Harlequins. Their recent single Wrong Way in the Right Lane is our current coolest song in the world. Back in 2015, they had the coolest song of the year in our 10th annual listeners poll with Tripping to the Light. Got Jeremy here with me now. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good, and I'm very happy we had a chance to get together again. You got a lot of stuff that's been going on in the interim, got a coolest song going on right now. You know, when we spoke a few years ago about the band and how you guys formed, but I don't believe we actually talked much about your own roots and upbringing and where you were from. So I'm thinking maybe you were from Ohio. Is that right? Or where are you from originally?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm from Toledo, Ohio.
And how long did you live there? Is that where you were raised?
Pretty much born and raised. I lived there till I was, I think, like 25. And then basically my first band was out of there. I had a band called We Are the Fury, and we toured a lot. We actually toured with the New York Dolls. We toured with Silverchair, did Warped Tour a couple years. I didn't move to New York till pretty long after that. I think it was 2011, 2012 is when I made my way to New York, with a brief stint in between in Los Angeles. But yeah, I guess I'm a Midwestern boy at the roots, and but I've been in New York now for a while, so I kind of adopted that as well.
Well, I was seeing some or listening to some interview with you, and I know from the beginning the Harlequins had this kind of a roots or even rockabilly vibe to some of these first recordings, and this interview that I heard or I saw, I can't remember which, has you describing how you were listening to Ritchie Valens and Gene Vincent when you were like around 5 years old. Is that right?
That's right. You know, I was thinking about that. There must have been something going on. I grew up in the 80s, and I feel like that was like a resurgence of early rock and roll at that time. And I was, you know, 5 years old. I don't know what was going on, but I feel like my dad would play a lot of that for me. And I think maybe like the Ritchie Valens movie came out around then, the Buddy Holly movie came out. So I think it was like, there must have been something going on, because that was like, you know, growing up in the 80s and being a few years old, it's like, it wasn't like I was, you know, flipping through the radio channels at the time and finding it on my own. It was like, that's what people were listening to again or something.
Well, I do believe the Ritchie Valens thing was, Los Lobos had covered the tunes, and they were hits.
you know, Obama became a hit again. So yeah, that makes sense. So you heard that when you were pretty young. You mentioned your dad playing things for you. So there must have been music going on in the household. What were your parents into, and what were your parents into? What kind of music was going on in the household?
They're still into music. Like, they weren't, you know, professional musicians or anything, but you know, they're always playing music. They were very encouraging, always playing kind of, you know, the classic stuff, the stuff I think we all like. At the time, it was a lot of early rock and roll, which is what I kind of came back to. Growing up in the, born in the 80s, raised in the 90s and the 2000s, I kind of went through so many different phases. I had my goth phase, I had my punk phase, and it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I kind of like got back into being a 5-year-old again, and coming back to early rock and roll. And I think it was kind of a reaction to what was going on musically at the time. Like, my first band, We Are the Fury, we kind of came up in the mid-2000s, and by, I think, 2012, around the time we started Jeremy and the Harlequins, it felt like rock and roll was getting really bloated, and it wasn't as cool as it was maybe 5 years before that. And I don't know if I think I remember talking about this a little bit back, you know, a few years ago, but it seemed like I could have gone two directions. It seemed like all my friends were becoming DJs and getting into electronic music, and that's just so far from where I'm at, and still very far from where I'm at. And I felt the only place rock could go at the time was to strip it back down and go back to the roots. And because no one was doing that, it felt honest to me, but it also felt like really refreshing. And it felt like the only place that we could go at the time. So that's the first record, American Dreamers, definitely very influenced by like rockabilly, early rock and roll. Everyone from Buddy Holly, and, you know, a lot of the Sun Records stuff, but also like Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and stuff like that.
When did you start playing guitar?
I started playing 6 or 7 years old. My parents got me an acoustic guitar because I'd walk around the house playing a broomstick, yeah, pretending it was a guitar. And I mean, I took lessons from the point I was like seven years old. But I don't feel like I really cared about it until I was like 12. And I think the magic happened. My brother started playing the drums. And I think that's when I realized like it wasn't just practicing at a little music studio with a guitar teacher anymore. It was like we could actually play songs and sing songs. It like felt like a real thing that we could participate in. And after that, it was kind of like, all right, this is what I'm doing. I'm just, you know, there's nothing else I really want to do. I think I was 13 when we played like the junior high school dance. That was like one of my first band.
Is that with your brother?
This one wasn't. The next band, when we started what was then to become We Are the Fury, I think I was 15 or 16. My brother was 12 or 13. And we were like one of the first bands in Toledo to play like the clubs, like the actual like bars, and you know, we're, you know, bringing junior high and high school kids, and they'd you know, have to leave after we would play. But I mean, it was at a time where like I think that's more common now, but at the time it was like we were the only people doing that, like, you know, 13 year old kids playing at a 21 and up venue. And this was like, I mean, I remember like this was like,
so your parents would drop you off at sound check?
They would drop us off. Sometimes they would stay for the show. And then, like, especially my brother driving back, I think it was like I was just getting my driver's license at the time so I could drive. But, you know, we were good kids back then. You know, we just played and then went home. But, like, I mean, that's what it's about. Like, that makes it really difficult to do anything else after that. Just, like, the energy, like, that you feel when you're that age, playing shows like that, like, I don't know. Yeah, it changed my life, I guess.
And here we are. So wait, so We Are the Fury, that kind of has its origins in high school. And how long did that band exist?
The same guys, we started playing together in the late 90s, and we kind of disbanded, I'd say, like 2009, 2010. We tried to keep it going, and then we started losing members. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, everyone, like from our management and everyone, was like, yeah, just find new guys. But that band was like really particular because it was like we grew up from being 12 or 13 years old playing together, that the idea of replacing people was just so foreign to us at that time. It was like never played with anyone else. And then when I started even, you know, after that band, I realized like I was a pretty good writer. I feel really strong at performing and touring at that time, but I had no idea how to find musicians to put a band together. So I would look for people, and like they wouldn't know how to, you know, read my brain. They wouldn't know how to just gel and know what I wanted before I wanted it. And that's something that I don't know if I still have found that to the same way. And I think that's like a special thing. And it's really difficult to find that when you get older as a musician. You can find like great musicians who do things and make songs into pieces that you can't think of. But to have that kind of hive mind band mentality is something that takes a long time. And I think like it's a real special thing when you start that at a really young age. And when you're in high school doing that and stuff, you don't even think about the next year, the next 5 years. All you're doing is just playing together. And so you're so in it. And then you just develop this kind of this brain that together. And it was, for 10 years, that's what it was like, I think.
Well, so I got two questions out of that. The first is about your brother. Does he still play music?
So he was in Jeremy and the Harlequins up until right around the time the COVID pandemic happened. He got married. He has a beautiful 2-year-old now, and it's just, you know, it's difficult. He'll still play a few times. Like we kind of have some different drummers jumping in for live stuff. And then the guy I work with in the studio, we kind of do it. It's like a whole different kind of thing now than when we started. I still write the songs and sing the songs, but we still play together though. We're really close. So.
And does he live in the New York area?
Yeah, he's on the Upper East Side. I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay. Well, then the second thing leading into this, and maybe it help, maybe part of this is, has to do with the gentleman you referred to working in the studio with. Let's see, you have to help me with his last name. So the first name is Mike. Is it Abizio?
Abiso.
Okay. All right. So the first part of this is, you know, what's up to with your brother? What's he doing? And the second part is, and you seem to be alluding to this, talking about, is it putting bands together and so forth. So from the lineup of Jeremy and the Harlequins, is it really just yourself and getting other musicians to play with you, back you when you're live, perhaps, or
yeah, and that's what it evolved into. And one thing, like, I think even as departing from We Are the Furious, like when I started Jeremy and the Harlequins, I wanted to have the ability to kind of do it forever. It was kind of a traumatic shock when that band broke up for me, because I didn't know exactly how to conceptualize a band without, you know, the same guys. Yeah. So when I started this one, I'm like, look, I know, people are going to have kids. People are going to get married. People are going to have jobs. They might join other bands. So I wanted a way of doing it to where, you know, the whole thing wouldn't fall apart if this person, you know, left or, right, you know, decided that music wasn't for them. So, it was kind of in the back of my mind. Not that I would, if things worked out and it was the same guys that we started with, that would be incredible. That's like I was saying before, that's, I think, the ideal scenario. But I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think of any bands, even the Stones. It's like, you eventually, there's new people who come in and you just kind of roll with it. So. But that was my thinking going into it.
Tell me something about the Mike, because he's working with you in the studio. He's on, you know, our Kudos song, The Wrong Way in the Right Lane. At least according to liner notes I have, it says that he supplied the, I think the drums and the bass guitar. So what's your relationship with him?
It's the craziest thing. I mean, I think the best thing to do in music is keep an open mind. And it took me a long time to learn that. I met Mike, we both kind of do some like music licensing writing, whether it's for TV and film, some commercials and stuff like that. I was introduced to him through one of the people that we work with at a company called Secret Road. And she was like, oh, you got to meet Mike. He's super talented. He's an amazing producer, great engineer. And we eventually, after a few phone calls, I went to his studio. And we started working together on stuff outside of the band stuff. And at some point, I'm like, wow, this guy's really good. Not only is he a great engineer and producer, he's like really talented. Just, I think at bass playing and guitar, he's incredible. And not a bad drummer either. But it was kind of like a perfect scenario. And especially with the Jeremy and the Harlequin stuff, like I'm very guarded about maintaining like the sound that I want to have. Like I'm really particular. So it took me like probably 3 to 6 months of us working together on other stuff before I was like, hey, I got all these Jeremy and the Harlequin songs that I'm not sure how to record right now. You want to give one a shot? And we worked on it and I was like, wow, this sounds really cool. Like some of the best stuff that I think we've done in a while. And he kind of contributed to it too. It wasn't just like he was playing the parts that I would show him. He is coming up with like cool vocal parts. He comes up with, I'm a pretty good writer of harmonies and stuff, but I think he's maybe even better. So it was like a really good scenario that I've never been a part of something like that, especially through a referral. I think I you know, it's maybe a fault of mine. I never feel like it's like kind of like being set up on a blind date. Like you kind of think it's not going to work out. And maybe usually it doesn't, or maybe it works out for some things. But yeah, I was not expecting to work with him as much as we're working together now. But I think it's coming out really great. Right now we're recording a lot of new music and we're putting out one single a month, building towards the next album.
Well, let's talk some more about Wrong Way in the Right Lane. I really love this lyric in there. You're ready for a real heartache at the cross streets of heart and break. I like that a lot.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So did for this one, did the lyrics or did the music come first?
The lyric Wrong Way in the Right Lane came at the same time as I was just playing the kind of blues riff on the guitar. And it was like one of those lyrics that I was like, and I like lyrics like this where you say it and it just kind of comes out of nowhere. You don't really know where it comes from. But once you have that one lyric, you kind of know what the rest of the song is going to be about. And then it was pretty easy to write it after that. And I just kind of liked the lyric because it kind of pointed exactly to, I mean, it could have been about a few different things, but I think it was like meant to be about this. And I think people hear it and they kind of know what you're talking about, especially after a few lines in the first verse.
And when did you get the idea for it? When did this, was it from a more recent thing or you've been sitting on it for a while or what?
Actually, so this is funny. I'm just thinking about it now. Our last album that we did, we actually did at Renegade Studios, Little Steven's studio.
Is that Abracadabra or?
Yeah. Abracadabra recorded that. I think, you know, it was in 2020. I believe it was the first full record that was done after the pandemic, or I guess while the pandemic was still going on. I think we recorded it in October of 2020. I'm just trying to think back now. It's been so long. But we finished that up. That came out in 2022. It didn't even come out on vinyl till a little bit after that. But Wrong Way in the Right Lane I believe was the first song that I wrote after that album came out. I usually take a few months off to kind of like just reflect and see. I mean, that sounds kind of, I don't know, arrogant. But I take a few months off to just kind of reset, because I want the next record to be a little bit different. I don't want it to be a continuation. And I also kind of feel like with a record, with an album, it's like you're saying something with an album. And one, I don't want to say the same thing that I just said. And so I need a little bit of space. But a few months after that came out is when I think I started writing Wrong Way in the Right Lane. And yeah, it was the first song that I wrote after that record came out. So I think that was probably maybe two and a half years ago, 3 years ago.
And you finally, and so when did you go into the studio to record, to birth this baby?
Recorded this, I think, in November or December of last year. And it was never like a plan to like do this one single a month thing. It's just I've like kind of had a backlog of songs. And I didn't really have like a set band. Like every other Harlequins record was like, you know, maybe we needed a bass player, or maybe we needed a guitar player, but like really it came down, it was just myself. So I was kind of figuring out a way to like, how is the next record going to get made? The beauty of that was that I just kept writing songs. So like still to this day, I probably have about 20, 25 songs that aren't recorded, that I want to record. But when I started recording, I think, I'm trying to think what was the first one. I think we did this song called The Whiskey Shake.
Okay. That came out already, right? Last year, maybe?
Yeah, that came out last year. I'm just trying to remember now. But yeah, I think, you know, we started working on stuff maybe about a year ago. And now we work together. We probably record 1 to 2 songs a month. And still there's a few in mixing stages right now, and we're just kind of building towards putting out the next record. I always think that's my goal. I don't even know how people listen to music anymore. You know, I like vinyl and I also like Spotify. I think there's a lot of different options. But I don't know, there's something about an album that just feels good.
Well, let me ask you this then. So you got one coming out, a finished single coming out each month. You're going to wait 12 months, or are we going to go 2 years and get a double album?
You know, I think what I need is the right label to kind of come on board. And if they want to do a double album, we can do a double album. I think an album would be sufficient. And then, you know, start working on the follow up to that one. But yeah, I think, you know, just like kind of talking about like where the industry or where music's at, it's like, I think any artist can put out singles, but I do think like having a label is kind of, unless you got deep pockets, like a label is pretty essential to putting out albums. Because I feel like, you know, to do the whole album thing, like you want to be able to tour and you want to be able to do it right. Cause it's a lot of work and it's a lot of like effort. And, I'd like to pretend that songwriting was easy, but it's kind of difficult.
Well, you mentioned touring, being able to tour.
Yeah.
Do you still want to tour? How important is touring to you?
I want to be in the place where there's a demand for the tour. I used to be at a place where I think I just wanted to tour. When I was in my 20s, all I did was want to tour. And the music was kind of a vehicle to tour. Now I think it's the opposite. I think I want to be in a place where like a song's doing well, the album's doing well, or, you know, someone wants to take us on tour. Where there's the demand to hear this live, you know? And I think that's what it has to be, especially, I've never kind of done this as like, I don't want to say like a solo artist, but that's kind of what it feels like at this point. And, you know, I know what that means for getting band members involved. I want them to be excited. You know, the worst thing is like, and it happens, it's going to happen again. You go to a venue and there's five people there. That happens to a lot of bands. So I'm not saying, you know, I can't have that, but, you know, just to where it's, there's that excitement about touring and everyone's excited. And, you know, again, with a label thing, it's like, they're excited, the band's excited, people are excited, and the songs are right. And, you know, I feel like that's when touring is the best.
Well, so we've been talking here somewhat about just about touring in general. Do you have any upcoming gigs specifically that are going on in the New York area anytime soon or next couple of months?
No. And I feel all right about it, actually. I'm really kind of enjoying just recording and writing. I kind of feel like when it's time to tour, it's going to happen, and it's going to happen big and right. I used to get a lot of anxiety about that, like feeling like, what are we doing wrong? Like, we should be on the road. Like, and I kind of lean back a little bit more and trust that, you know, things are going to work out when they're supposed to work out. I know, like, there's been times in my life where I've been on the road for like 3 or 4 years. You start getting to that place where you're like, man, I just want to be home for a bit, or I just want to write for a bit, or I just want to like hang out with my friends and my family. And so I feel like I'm just trying to enjoy this process of writing and recording and you know, living life. And when the tour thing happens again, and I'm sure it will, then, you know, we'll go into that mode.
So I want us to talk some about Cowboy from New York. But before I do that, there's something when we were talking about Mike, and I just thought this is pretty interesting where, so you're, I don't know if we call it a day job, but one of the things you do to make money is to, you're involved in like a commercial songwriting, like, is it jingles or what is it that you and Mike do?
Yeah. I used to be into it more, a few years back. That whole industry has kind of changed a little bit too. Mike does that, still quite a bit. But yeah, I've done a bunch, everything from like Miller High Life to Royal Caribbean to Nestle to Smirnoff, just to name some brands, I guess.
Is it like writing specifically jingles, or you were creating the backing music for the like background music that's seated behind at the commercial as it's going on?
You know, for Miller High Life, a few years ago, we actually redid their 70s jingle for them, and it was a fun process because we totally flipped it. And then sometimes they, you know, they just want like a fun rock song. So it's like, it just depends on the project. I think what I'm best at is, you know, doing rock, like pop rock. I don't know, however you want to call it. Something in the Americana rock and roll world. I've tried to do stuff outside of that, and I think I'm okay at it.
Well, that's cool, because you know what, you were when we were talking earlier, you were talking about having gone through these different sort of music phases, you know, years ago. You had your goth thing going on, and that turns out that was important, because you can draw on that later on when you know, you were in that work environment needing something, some genre the normal you wouldn't have been drawn to. Yeah, that's all very cool stuff.
It is kind of funny, like sometimes I kind of put myself in the mind of like where I was at when I was 13. Sometimes it's like where I was at when I was 18, which is it's a trip. It's kind of fun to kind of go back to that world for a few hours or a few days.
Well, so our coolest song in the world this week, which is Wrong Way in the Right Lane, that came out like in January. But you have a more recent single that came out last month in March. It's called Cowboy from New York. So, Jeremy, does a cowboy from New York still ride?
Definitely.
Yeah. And how much of Lefty's story mirrors your own? How much is The Cowboy from New York your own story?
A little bit. I mean, I think some parts are slightly obvious, but I think with everything I write, nothing. I don't think I've written one song where it's like I'm like kind of doing an autobiography. I kind of pull pieces from maybe my life or maybe a relationship or you know, but really it's all to kind of serve the song. You know, I think that's like I try to kind of like look at it as I'm like writing the song and what can I do to serve the song? What experience do I have to kind of pull from to make this song resonate more with people, as opposed to kind of using it as like my therapy session. And maybe it, you know, becomes that at some point anyway, but yeah, there's pieces. I mean, you know, I moved to New York, started a band. So that's all true. You know, but I don't know if the, maybe the end is true too. I don't know. He goes off on his own at the end. Maybe that is a little bit true. Maybe I'm like, you know, self-fulfilling my own prophecy.
Oh, he rides on. So you mentioned Wrong Way and The Right Lane kind of being written after Abracadabra came out in 2022, a couple of months off, and then this one kind of comes along, or that one does. What about Cowboy from New York? When does this, is that a more recent composition?
This was actually written during the pandemic. This was even, you know, going to be on Abracadabra, and I couldn't figure out how to play it right. We kept trying to flip it. I think, you know, I think that at the time we had this vision of what that record was going to be. And I don't think Cowboy from New York fit on it, even though I think lyrically it would have been really good at the time. Lyrically, the song I really pulled from this idea. Like, I remember during COVID, like especially in Brooklyn, everyone was walking around with bandanas wrapped around their face, going into stores and riding bikes. And it kind of looked like everyone was a cowboy.
Or banditos.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of like a loose inspiration for it. I remember, you know, writing it and, but obviously it's, you know, more of a story. Just that was kind of like, I guess, the visual.
This guy playing pedal steel on there, Jeff Lampert, who is he? Because he does a lot to contribute to the kind of vibe of the song there.
For sure. There's this whole new like kind of country scene that is blowing up in Brooklyn and Manhattan right now. And I think pretty much everywhere, like everywhere is into country music right now. We've kind of, I think, like, you know, rockabilly and early rock and roll isn't too far a departure for it. But anyway, I met Jeff. He's been around forever. He's an incredible pedal steel player. He plays at a place called Desert Five Spot and Skinny Dennis in Brooklyn. And if you go there, you'll see him. He's unbelievable. You can just watch him play. And your jaw kind of drops. I think there was like a karaoke night at Desert Five Spot. He heard me sing. He was like, we should do something together. I was like, we will. You know, I didn't know what at the time, but then we recorded this song. And I was like, all right, this is, we gotta have this. The song's not right without pedal steel on it. And it was like one of those things, like a guy like that comes in the studio, you don't have to tell him what to do. You just hit record and have him do it a few times and, you know, you get magic.
That's because he's a musician.
Yep. I've met people who've called themselves musicians and it doesn't happen that way all the time.
Right, right. Well, when they self-identify, that can be kind of a red flag, you know.
Yeah. You
know? If they know, they know. You're like, oh yeah, because you'd already seen him, right, performing and wild, and then you're like, oh yeah, you know.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I remember, you know, talking to Mike actually about it, and he was like, you know, we were trying to get a, you know, he's a gigging musician, he's busy, a lot, and it was like hard to lock down the actual session to get him in the studio. And Mike was like, we could get, you know, I know this other guy. And I was like, no, we're just going to wait. That is another good thing about this kind of scenario that we're in right now. Like if it were a record, we'd have to get someone, because we'd have to get the record to the label at the right time.
Right.
But this is like, oh, let's finish up this other single first, and we'll come back to this when we can get Jeff on it. But I was like pretty adamant, like, Jeff's got to play on this. That's the only way this is going to be sounding the way it needs to sound.
Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again. It's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure speaking with you as always. We're going to give a listen now to the latest single from Jeremy and the Harlequins. It's Cowboy from New York and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I never thought it ever end, but here I am alone again. My guitar, my only friend, faithful at my side. Like the cowboys in the West, God ain't grant me time to rest. I can't shake her off my chest, telling me to ride, ride. Well, Lefty came from Ohio because the wind decided so. Brought a bag of dreams in tow. One day he'll plant down, slinging whiskey in Times Square. He met a bunch of bandits there. They bet on him to sing their prayer and make it in this town. Well, he's never crossed the plains of Oklahoma, and he's never shot a Colt 45. But he's cut from the same cloth as Jesse James. The cowboy from New York still rides.
With some of their single, Cowboy from New York, that's Jeremy and the Harlequins here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Jeremy for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Longtime favorites of ours here in the Underground Garage, the Minus Five, have got a new single out called Let the Rope Hold Cassie Lee. It's off an upcoming album, and joining us to talk about the single and the new full-length is founding member Scott McCoy. He's my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.